Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for June 14th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host Bob Bupka. And Bob, today, as you well know, is Flag Day. Therefore, it makes perfect sense that we'll be talking about the 122nd United States Open Golf Championship this week at the Country Club outside of Boston. We'll also be joined by the Open Doctor himself, the great golf course architect, Rhys Jones, who transformed that golf course and restored it back to what made it terrific to begin with at the Country Club. And of course, we will be discussing the ramifications of the first week of LIV Golf and what it all means going forward. My friend, we had a lot to cover.
We really do. And it's just great, a great feeling. Flag Day, the Country Club of Boston, you know, your patriotic feel for the United States Open. I think this has the potential to go down as one of the all-time great U.S. Opens. And what a pleasure and a thrill and an honor to have Rhys Jones be part of Musings on Sports.
Well, and it is, and he was a huge part of why the United States Golf Association decided to go to the Country Club in 1988. He really looked at a lot of what had made the Country Club, the golf course there, great. Restored it to a lot of its original layout, and Curtis Strange was a most worthy champion that year. It is the week of the U.S. Open, but doggone it, if the discussions haven't been and continue to be about LIV Golf, so much so, my friend, that Brooks Koepka, I understand, got a little testy with some reporters this morning during his press conference where, you know, he wanted to talk about the U.S. Open, and justifiably so, but the questions continue to rain down about LIV Golf, much like the 30 questions that Mickelson was asked yesterday, 29 pertain to LIV Golf. I kind of feel badly for the USGA. Maybe if we could just sort of get this over today and then get on with what really matters, which is going to be a great championship on a hell of a golf course.
Well, you're so right, Kelly, and it's really starting to bubble over LIV Golf. I mean, come on. It is the week of the United States Open. All attention should be directed to that. The players, one by one, you know, they're getting tired of answering questions. The ones that haven't opted to go with LIV do not want, and I don't blame them, they don't want to talk about the players that did go. It's a personal decision. It's a business decision. And, you know, let's leave it at that. I mean, if you can't focus on golf at the U.S. Open, then forget about covering golf. I mean, if you need a distraction like LIV Golf to sell your papers or to sell your publications or whatever, then I think maybe it's time for a lot of the media to get in another business. This is going to be a great U.S. Open on a great golf course, and that's what we're going to focus on right here on Musings on Sports.
Just a quick couple of notes before we move on to the U.S. Open, and I feel like I think we need to address it. I wrote extensively in my Monday Musings on my Facebook page about what I viewed as some winners and losers coming out of LIV Golf. I think Norman was a big winner just based on getting the event, the first event started, and the players he essentially poached from the PGA Tour. You had Charles Schwartzel win $4.75 million, more than he's won in the last 4 years competitively combined. I think Rory, on the conversely, was a big winner. The great show that he and Justin Thomas and Tony Finau put on in the final round up in Canada. There's a lot of ramifications to this, as I pointed out earlier, Bob. And I think it will be, I tell you what would, to me, would be the most interesting thing is sort of how the locker room is this week at the Country Club among guys who have been friends. Is Justin Thomas spending any time with Dustin Johnson? What are those relationships like? But again, as you pointed out, and I agree, once the gun goes off, if you will, on Thursday morning and everything gets started, that's where the focus needs to be.
Yeah, you're so right, Kelly. And who knows what's going to happen inside the locker room. Right now, you know, all the players are saying the right things. Well, that's his decision. It's got nothing to do with me. But at some point, the ones that have opted to go to LIV, If it starts to become apparent that it might be doing damage to the PGA Tour for the players that have stayed, that's when it could get a little testy.
Agreed. Yeah, the next live event will start the end of this month in Portland, Oregon. So enough said about that. Let's get on to what does matter the most. And really, now maybe we understand even more what matters most in professional golf, and that's the four major golf championships. I want to talk about Rees Jones in a minute. We certainly want to talk about the Country Club. But I want you, Robert, to share a couple of terrific classic U.S. Open stories that you mentioned to me earlier that I think fit perfectly with what Musings on Sports is all about in terms of great storytelling.
Well, thank you, Kelly. I was, on the eve of this championship, I couldn't help but think back. First one that came to mind was 1998, to be exact, and Payne Stewart had just lost to Lee Jansen at the Olympic Club. And I was doing the runner-up interview with Payne Stewart when Payne said to me, his closing remarks in that interview, "Bob, I will win the U.S. Open at Pinehurst." Now we flash forward a year, and everybody that follows golf knows exactly what happened. Payne Stewart does go on to fulfill that promise he had made a year earlier. Unfortunately, it wasn't just about 3 months later that Payne was no longer with us. But I thought it was a very bold proclamation by Payne Stewart, and he certainly was bold. You just had to look the way he dressed emphatically that he was going to win. And that just sticks with me. And then more on a lighthearted side was we were at Pebble Beach in 2000, and that's when Tiger had that massive runaway victory. I was working for the USGA. They wanted me to do an interview with Tiger after he came out from the media center. So they had me in this van strategically placed near the exit. The plan was when Tiger finishes inside the media room, he'll be brought into the van. We'll give Tiger a ride to where he's going. And during that ride, I would be able to do my interview. So I'm waiting there anxiously. And it was a little longer than I had anticipated. But then I realized with what had happened on the golf course, that massive runaway victory by Tiger, it was going to be hard to end any interview in the media room. But finally, he comes out and he's on a cell phone, Kelly, and the van door slides open. Janice and I are sitting in the van. We have all our equipment ready to start to talk to Tiger, but he's on the cell phone. And so I'm not about to interrupt him, of course. But shortly after getting in the van, he says the following words: "Well, thank you, Mr. President. Certainly appreciate the phone call. Now, how can I help you, Bob?"
Yeah, the call from President Clinton, for some reason, had to take precedence over talking with Bob Bupka that day.
Absolutely, but never in my life. And you know, that was the first and only time somebody's going to be on the phone. "Thank you, Mr. President. What do you need, Bob?" I mean, the segue there was really quite comical. Those are just two of the stories. I mean, every U.S. Open has their own story, and I feel very confident, as I think you do, Kelly, that we're going to get a great story out of what transpires here at Brookline this week.
Yeah, I agree. And I mentioned in passing in regards to the 88 U.S. Open that Curtis Strange won. The last known memory for golf fans, though, of the Country Club is Justin Leonard and the 99 Ryder Cup, of him making that long putt and running across the green and the U.S. rallying from what seemed to be an impossible deficit to win on that magical Sunday if you're a U.S. fan. Over the Europeans. It's a great ball striking golf course. I'm a big fan of two players going into this. I'll get to that in a minute. But Rees Jones had pretty much everything to do with getting that golf course back to where it had been when, from its original design. And even he admits, as people are going to hear later, that it put him on the map, Bob. I mean, yeah, he was the son of Robert Trent Jones, and that was great. But this was back in 1988. He became the open doctor at that point, and it's only continued in droves in terms of him being the one and going into upgrading, restoring, whatever you want to call, a significant number of major courses, of big-time courses, ahead of major championships.
Well, you know, I've had so many architects tell me that it takes a tremendous amount of talent to create a golf course. Okay, that's well understood. But they also go on to say that it takes even more talent to restore a previously great golf course back to its greatness. And I think Rees Jones had more talent than any other architect alive in the ability to do that. When you look at the PGAs that he's done, the Ryder yeah. Cups that he's done, I mean, that talent was recognized. And I think that's a huge part of his legacy. And certainly the job that he did at Brookline back in the 80s, bringing it back to almost identical to what Francis We Met had to endure back in 1913, was quite a task by Rees, and we're certainly proud to have him on today's show.
Well, and I'm excited for our listeners to hear it. You mentioned Mr. We Met's name, and in so many ways, that 13 Open was kind of really the beginning of American golf in many respects, Bob, and all the stories of him beating the great the great British players to win the U.S. Open, and a guy who lived literally just around the corner from the country club. It began what's been an incredible tale of American professional golf, and really American golf in many ways, over the ensuing 100 plus years.
And to not to rub it in, but to make a bucket list people out there, and we certainly have a lot of them that listen to Musings on Sports. Following that Ryder Cup, I was able to play the country club, left immediately to go to Long Island, played Maidstone, which is a gem of a golf course located on the east end of Long Island. We played Maidstone. We left that night. The next morning, we got up bright and early. We went and played Shinnecock, and we capped it off with a round at National Golf Links of America. So Brookline, oh Maidstone, gosh. Shinnecock, National, in the span of about 48 hours, a trip that I'll never forget. And with me was Brian Hewitt, who was with Golf Week at the time, Jeff yeah. Rude, good Great friend guys. Of yours, also yep. with Golf Week. Yeah. Ask them right now, best golf trip they've ever had, that's the one they'll refer to.
Oh, what a trip. And I've had so many people tell me that they can only dream to live the life of Bob Bubka and to have those, that couple of days. That's just a microcosm of it. Really cool stuff there, Bob. All right, I'm going to give you two names for this week. And they're not surprises. I mean, I don't think there's a better ball striker in the game than Justin Thomas. You saw it over and over again at Southern Hills. And I also like Cameron Smith, the Australian with the mullet. He's much more than an old style hairdo that's maybe been out of vogue for about the last 30 years. He's really good, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen with him. He's going to win something at a major level. Maybe I kind of feel like it's this week. If it isn't, it's not too far away. Who do you like?
Well, Kelly, I'm glad to hear that neither one of your two picks, and we didn't discuss this before going on air. Mine are two completely different picks. I think the winner is going to come out of one Scottie Scheffler, certainly number one ranked player in the world. He has every qualification needed to win a U.S. Open. He's reigning Masters champion. And then I think the other one might surprise you a little bit, and it's Shane Lowry. There's no more Irish concentration in the United States than in and around the Boston area. And if Shane Lowry gets it going over the weekend, that crowd will almost will him to victory. So Scheffler and Lowry from this corner.
Great call. Love the Irish connection there in Boston. This has been great. Really enjoyed this discussion with you, Bob. As I mentioned, a lot on the golf plate right now. And in a minute, we're going to hear from a gentleman by the name of Reese Jones, who, yeah, he was the son of a legendary golf course architect in Robert Trent Jones. But based on what he did at the Country Club in 1988 and what he's done many times over beyond that, he has certainly made a name for himself. And we'll hear from Reese Jones right after these words from our friends at Titleist.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin here, along with Bob Bupka. And Bob, with the 122nd U.S. Open set to begin Thursday at the Country Club outside of Boston, we are absolutely delighted to welcome in a man who knows all about preparing a golf course for major championships. He readied the Country Club the last time our national championship was staged there. And sure enough, he continues to play a major role in golf course design and restoration. He is the Open Doctor, Reese Jones. Reese, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thank you, Kelly and Bob.
You know, Reese, we go back to the year 1988. And even before I ask that question, it's well known that your dad was one of the great architects, golf architects of all time. How difficult was it when you look back to be a son of somebody so successful in the field, and then you make the conscious decision to go into that same field? Was that a tough choice on your part?
Well, yes and no. I really didn't decide until I was a junior in college and I took the courses to get into the Harvard School of Design. But, yeah, and it was tough go to begin with. And the Country Club really catapulted my career when they hired me to restore the golf course in 1985 prior to the 1988 Open. And that's really what I learned from my father, because he was the guy that they went to prior to my time to bring the golf courses up to date and prepare them for the U.S. Open. So it was a really exciting experience for me to be involved with the Country Club, which is just a great place, a great club with great people.
Yeah, it's exciting for us to have you on Musings. You remodeled 7 U.S. Open venues, 9 PGA Championship courses, 6 Ryder Cup, 2 Walker Cup sites, as well as 3 President Cup venues, plus Eastlake Golf Club in Atlanta, home to the Tour Championship. Now, you talk about resumes. I mean, that is a resume beyond resumes. Is there a design philosophy that you follow when you go to work on redesigning or restoring a great golf course?
Well, I was lucky when I was young. I traveled with my father a lot when he went to different jobs. I played junior golf around the metropolitan New York area. I saw a lot of the architects work. I think what I really focused on is really complying with the original designer's concept and really studying those concepts and trying to embrace them when appropriate and improve them and change them when necessary. So that's what restoration is all about. It isn't really just going back to the original design. It's really estimating what is important for today's play and today's players. And I think that's what they've done at the Country Club for this year's tournament.
Well, the great golf course architect, Reese Jones, with us on Musings on Sports. Hey, Reese, when it came to that hiring in 85 for the 88 Open, what were the specific tasks? What did they want you to accomplish to get the Country Club ready for the 88 Open?
Well, the USGA went back to the Country Club because it was the 75th anniversary of Francis Wee Metz's victory. And so, and nothing had really been done. It had gone through the Depression and World War. The golf course had sort of been neglected at that time and really had been left in the same state after World War II for a long time. So I was brought in to restore it. It was the first restoration project, I think, in America of major consequence. We had to rebuild three greens that had been changed and really were out of context. Then we had to take the turf we got from those greens and reestablish all the hole locations that had been lost, because during the Depression, they mowed the greens, all the greens, in a round fashion. Then we went to the photographs and we put the chocolate drops back in that had been eliminated for maintenance purposes. Then we also found all the bunkers that had been eliminated to save money and dug holes and found sand, especially on what is the eighth hole, I believe, in this U.S. Open tournament. It's normally the ninth hole. So it was the first restoration. I think it led to the restorations that we see today, which is very appropriate for the days going sort of back to the future, in essence.
You know, let me ask you this, Reese. There's a lot of concern that so many modern-day, the modern-day golf game is on the verge of making some real golf course gems in this country and around the world obsolete because they're just not long enough. Are you part of that concern?
To some degree, yes. And also the way the golf course is set up. Last week's Canadian Open, the scores were very low. And that's because they're really hitting the ball so far and really having very little length left into the greens. And they're so accurate, those short irons. It's not just the equipment itself, but it's the player's ability. And I think what John Bodenhammer has done so well in the last three U.S. Open since he took over the setup is he's set up the golf courses so that accuracy is very, very important. I think they sort of went away from that at Erin Hills and Chambers Bay, and I think that's why they're going back to the narrow fairways, the 3-inch, the 4-inch rough, and even some 5-inch rough at Brookline to make sure that you hit it down the middle of the fairway to be successful.
Reese Jones with us here on Musings on Sports. Reese, I want to go back to talking about your dad, Robert Trent Jones. Bob brought him up initially, and then you've elaborated on it some. Help me out to understand, in what ways did your dad's designs influence your work? And then maybe conversely, how are you different in your design approach from that of your dad?
Well, I think, routings, the layout of the holes is taken for granted. And I think my father is one of the best at that, of really finding 18 really great holes within a rugged piece of ground. And also, I think he was a master at contouring greens, so that you really had a different challenge every day in a four-day tournament. I think he really worked on four distinctly different hole locations that were challenging on every green that he designed. And I think that I learned that from him, and I think that's what led me into the Open Doctor title that I have now, because I really understood championship golf and how the greens are rotated around and how the setup is really out of the hands of the golf course architect. But you have to give the setup guy the opportunity to really make par a standard of excellence. And I think both he and I really believe that par is a standard of excellence. We love it when a single digit under par is the champion, not when it's 20-25 under par.
Reese, let me ask you, is there I'm assuming there's a very fine line between providing a thorough examination to the best players in the world and embarrassing the best players in the world.
Yeah, so that happened at the massacre at Winged Foot, and that was sort of a reaction from Johnny Miller, 63, at Oakmont. And I think the USGA learned about that, but now they're getting back to that somewhat of a setup, not quite as a deeper rough, because the clubs are so much better, and the strength of the players is so incredible. I mean, the rough was really treacherous at Winged Foot this last time, but Bryson DeChambeau was not affected by it. In fact, last year at Torrey Pines, he told me he wasn't going to play the course the way I designed it, and told me he was going to hit it in the rough on 4, hit it into the hospitality area on 7, hit it in the bunker on 17 on purpose, because he had those shots in his bag. So I think everybody has to consider how the strength of the players has changed, how the implements of the game have changed, So we have to adapt. I always thought, like that's why Torrey Pines is such a great U.S. Open venue, because those greens really are very meaningful to get close to the pin. Otherwise, you're challenged to make a par, and it's hard to make a birdie.
Reese, I imagine I'm like a lot of people, have always been fascinated by how someone has the vision to take a piece of land and turn it into a golf course, much less a championship golf course. When it comes to whether it's an original design or a restoration, how does the process work with a club or a golf course? How much of the vision is yours that they're giving to you, say, this is what we want you to do, as opposed to you giving your input? How does the process work, whether it's a restoration or a brand new design?
I think you have to custom design every job. You have to custom design it in regard to the client's desires. You can't just have the same template and build the same golf course in every case, whether it be a private club, a public entity, a resort course. You really have to make sure that the game is enjoyed and that people are capable of succeeding on any golf course you design. To some degree, courses got to be too difficult back in the 70s and 80s, and I think we as architects are now much more aware of having shot options, bailouts, greens that hold the shot rather than reject them. Make sure that if a person exercises the strategy and executes the shot, we're going to reward them and we're not going to over-penalize them. So I think, like at the Breakers, I've built two distinctly different golf courses. The one, the Ocean Course, is really popular. It's a shorter golf course, and a lot of the conventioneers get to play there and enjoy it. Then the West Golf Course, the Base Breakers Reese Jones Course, hosts its PGA Tour qualifying event. So you really have two distinctly different types of golf courses. So if you have a combination of courses, like Pinehurst does, where every player can find a place of comfortable challenge, then you're really doing your job.
You know, Reese, one of the challenges I would assume is you come in and raise a golf course to championship level, but immediately after that final putt is dropped, it goes back to the membership, and they still have to be able to play it and enjoy it. Is that a difficult thing to plug into the formula?
No, it really is. But I think the reason why my courses can adapt to exactly what you're talking about is that I design them now for the ground game as well as the aerial game. Tillinghast is sort of the guy that started that. He'd have an open half for the green, and then he'd have a protected green with a bunker and partially protecting the front. So there's a lot of shot options, and I think golfers have to understand not to go for the pin all the time, especially if it's heavily protected and they've got a long shot coming in. They go to the open entrance, two putt, and get out of town, much like Bryson was telling me at the fourth hole at Torrey Pines when he said he was going to hit in the right rough. And I said, what happens when the pin is left? He says, I'm going to the middle green, two putting, going to the fifth tee. And I think a lot of players have to understand, don't always go for the flag. Go to the place that will give you the best option of making par.
Hey, Reese, you mentioned Mr. Tillinghast and obviously your dad. Among some of the other great architects, who are the others who have influenced your career?
Well, I grew up on a Donald Ross course, and Ross had bunkers away from the green surfaces, and I think I'm doing a lot of that now. So he's influenced a lot of architects in the game. And I think McKenzie, because he was so creative in his sculptured bunkers and his contouring of greens, was so well done. I think Augusta National is such a great model for golf course architects, because it is a place where the everyday player can enjoy himself, and it does challenge the best of the game with the green contours, the elevated greens, the approaches, the targets in the fairway, which are relatively understandable. And so McKenzie, I think, has had a great deal of influence. I think Tillinghast, McKenzie, and Ross are probably the most influential architects from the past.
Hey, Reese, I had a chance, within the last 6 months or so, I played the Blue Course at Congressional. I'm from the D.C. area originally, and they've undergone, to say it's a transformation is an understatement. It's a massive overhaul of that championship course just removed so many trees to put it back to where they felt that was, you know, sort of the original design. Do you have a particular thought, philosophy, et cetera, on the vast removal of trees, a la what Oakmont did and now what Congressional has done? As Congressional prepares, they're going to have the KPMG Women's PGA Championship later this month, the PGA Championship, and then the 37 Ryder Cup. Good, bad? How do you feel about the vast removal of trees?
Well, I think tree removal on a selected basis is a good idea, because you want to make sure if a person hits into the trees, he's got a shot to get out. And if you have an open entrance green, then you can hit a low shot and get on the surface. This mass removal of trees is at Oakmont was appropriate because Founds, the architect, really was trying to build an inland links. So a lot of people followed that pattern, but that was a specific boutique golf course. Other clubs that are taking out all the trees have really diminished the possibility of having a real challenge. In fact, I loved hearing Justin Thomas at Southern Hills talking about how much he loved the tree-lined fairways, and I know they love the tree-lined fairways at Eastlake. So I think we're going to get back to keeping selected trees and not totally taking them out, because they do challenge the golfer. They keep the golf course from being overwhelmed by the best players in the game, and they are a wonderful defining element of a golf hole. And from a global warming standpoint, we need more trees. We need a trillion more trees, so I think we need to keep them.
We appreciate Reese Jones joining us on Musing on Sports. Reese has been a friend for a long time. What major championship golf course restoration that you might label as the most challenging, and why was it so?
Well, that's a good question, because they're all different. I mean, I think maybe Bethpage Black may have not have been the most challenging, but the course had deteriorated. We had to bring it back to life. And then we knew we were going to have a U.S. Open there, and then we had another one, and now we're going to have the Ryder Cup coming up in 25. You know, it was just a wonderful opportunity. What was so great about Bethpage Black is nobody had changed the golf course. Like, Eastlake may have been much more challenging because we had to go back and talk to Charlie Harrison, Charlie Yates, Tommy Barnes, and Tom Cousins to understand what was there, because George Cobb completely changed that golf course. So we had to really do much more investigative work to get ready to restore that back to its original design. Whereas Bethpage Black, all the model was there, and all we had to do was really move some of the bunkers for today's players, move them into play, maybe add some length, but we had the model right in front of us. So I think it's more difficult when you really have a course that's been obliterated from the past to one that's stood the test of time and lasted forever.
Must be a great sense of pride for you, Reese. You're almost as busy as ever. People want the magic touch of Reese Jones on their golf course. What continues? Can you pinpoint what drives you to take on the workload that you're currently under, and looking forward to more projects in the future?
Well, I mean, just like you know, Bob and Kelly, the great thing about our profession is the great people in the game of golf, the great people we get to meet at the clubs, the great golf writers we have a lot of really wonderful friendships that have been developed through this game. And I just like hanging out with all you guys. Also, I think that what drives me is that I love what I do. I'm building a Wellman Country Club, Wellman Golf Club in Johnsonville, South Carolina, in a little small town. It's going to bring the whole area back to life. It's going to be a social center for the public golfer, just like Torrey Pines, Bayou Oaks, and Bethpage Black are. So, I mean, and the excitement of this golf course being built right now really gets into me, too. And just hanging around with the people that are going to enjoy that facility for the rest of their lives is really rewarding and really keeps me going. So, in fact, a writer just did an article on it, and he said, Reese, you've got a life force. And I guess maybe he's right, because I love what I do, and I love making people happy in the game of golf, and that's why I keep going.
Well, one area that Reed specializes in where he doesn't make people happy is when you tee off against him on the first hole. Quite a stick in his own right. Be sure to get enough shots. Reese Jones, a pleasure and an honor, sir, to have you with Kelly and me on Musing on Sports. It really has been a thrill. Continued success, and let's enjoy this U.S. Open.
We will. Thank you very much, guys.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Bob, I know you've been friends with Reese for a long time, but professionally, beyond the friendship, he's an extraordinary golf course architect, been honored many times over within his profession, and what he does for major championship venues, but for also for so many clubs and golf courses throughout the country. He's extraordinary.
He really is, and you know, he may be a wonderful architect, but he's even a better human being. He's the real deal. There's no airs put on by Reese Jones, and I echo your sentiments, Kelly. A pleasure and an honor to have Reese join us on this show. And now all that's left for all of our listeners, sit back, relax, and enjoy the United States Open as it comes to you from the Brookline Country Club.
Well, and it's going to be a terrific 4 days. Lots of coverage through the various platforms on NBC Sports. Hope everybody enjoys that. And speaking of NBC Sports, our guest next week will be one of the guys in the booth, Peter Jacobson, Mr. Enjoyable Guy to be around, one of the true gentlemen and funny guys for a long, long time on the PGA Tour and PGA Tour champions. He'll give us his perspective coming out of the country club, and I think he'll make us laugh a little bit as well, Bob. Thanks again for Reese. Looking forward to having Peter next week. Bob, always great being with you. Enjoy the U.S. Open. Happy Father's Day to you and to all of our listeners out there. Please continue to listen to Musings on Sports wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Kelly Elbin for Bob Bupka. Thanks for listening to Musings on Sports.